I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom. Welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is Professor James Loeffler, author of Exceptional Hatred, Anti-Semitism and the Fight Over Free Speech in Modern America. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18 at gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the hosts and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. This is the first Too Jewish show following the beginning of the final Hebrew calendar month of the year, the month of Elul. Rosh Hashanah is now slightly less than 4 weeks away. As we head for the end of this year and approach a new Jewish year, Rosh Hashanah starts September 11th, the night of the 25th anniversary of 9/11. Here on Too Jewish, we are going to look back on the last 11-plus months and how they have impacted and transformed the Jewish world. Last week, we explored how this Jewish year 5786 was experienced in Israel. Today, we're going to look at, the rest of the world, from America to Australia to England, over this complicated, messy Jewish year that is nearly past. Let's begin by noting that events in and around Israel, the Gaza War and its casualties, the initial stages of the Iran War as the first U.S.-Israeli joint war in history, the Israeli attacks on the Hezbollah terrorist territory in southern Lebanon, the U.S.-Iran stalemate over the Straits of Hormuz, the increases in oil prices, and the extreme negative attention focused on Israel and Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu have each and all had a significant major impact on Jews around the world. The rise in anti-Semitism on both the left and the right is often branded anti-Zionism, and the Jew haters use the familiar anti-Semitic lie of Jewish control of governments or media as evidence of undue Israeli influence. You know, it's those Jews again. For reasons that don't have much to do with the facts, Israel has become the worst nation in the world to some people, and Netanyahu the planet's arch-villain. When Jews are attacked, verbally and physically these days, the excuse is always that the attackers hate Israel or Netanyahu or both. No matter how little relationship there is between an Orthodox synagogue in Manchester or a beach party in Australia or a preschool at a Reform synagogue in Michigan and actual events or policies in faraway Israel. Now, that isn't to say that the dramatic rise in anti-Semitic propaganda and violence that took place all through this 5786 year can solely be attributed to the controversies swirling around Israel. But clearly the biggest and most painful stories of this past Jewish year have revolved around violent, fatal anti-Semitic attacks, the radicalized Muslims perpetrating them, all supposedly to take revenge against Jews wherever we live. Last Yom Kippur, a synagogue in Manchester, England, was attacked by a terrorist. Two congregants were killed on this holiest day of the year, and a much greater disaster averted only by the fast action of British police who killed the terrorist. In case you were wondering, the murderer's first name was Jihad. Horrifyingly, last December, in a Hanukkah on the Beach event at Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia, a father and son team of anti-Semitic terrorists who had been radicalized by Islamic State propaganda and an agent of Islamic State murdered 15 people, 11 men, 3 women, and a 10-year-old girl. They wounded 40 more people, including a Syrian hero who stopped them from killing even more people. Among the murdered victims was a Holocaust survivor. The attackers were radicalized by an Islamic State agent in Sydney. Their goal was to murder Jews. There is evidence that Australian authorities ignored information that at least one of the terrorist murderers had been planning the attack. In March, just a few months after Bondi Beach, a Hezbollah-connected terrorist tried to murder preschool children at Temple Israel in suburban Detroit, driving a car filled with gasoline bombs and fireworks into the building. Also in March and April, the Jewish community in London was the target of a wave of anti-Semitic attacks, arson, and vandalism, all directed at synagogues, community charities, schools, and individuals. The campaign's worst incidents were the Hatzolah ambulance arson, in which they blew up ambulances used to help Jews who were in physical distress, and the Golders Green stabbings, which were random stabbings of Jewish people walking on the street. Responsibility for this wave of terror was claimed by a front group for Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC. They had outsourced the London terror attacks to local criminals in England in order to maintain plausible deniability while they attacked Jews. Those attacks prompted a major counterterrorism investigation in Britain. There were dozens of arrests, increased security across northwest London, but also increased fear among British Jews. Meanwhile, in U.S. politics, the ascendance in the Democratic Party of progressives or Democratic socialists, who typically are strongly anti-Israel and sometimes flat-out anti-Semites, caused serious stress throughout the American Jewish world over the last 11 months. New York City, location of the largest Jewish population of any city in the world, elected Zoran Mamdani as mayor. You would have to know that unless you were under a rock for the last, 6 months. Mamdani's father and mother are Holocaust deniers. Mamdani quickly removed city protections from synagogues, threatened to arrest Bibi Netanyahu if he came to New York, and generally adopted strong anti-Israel and borderline anti-Semitic policies and positions. In Michigan and Wisconsin, anti-Israel Democratic progressives have been nominated for Senate and the governorship, and one of them, Al-Sayed in Michigan, clearly embraces anti-Semitic conspiracy theorists. On the right wing of politics in America, conservative influencers, including the popular anti-Semite conspiracy theorist Tucker Carlson, have become increasingly influential and, frankly, crazier. This has been, to say the least, a challenging 57-86 year here in the U.S., following a year when there were multiple violent terror attacks in Boulder, Colorado, and Washington, D.C., even in the governor's mansion in Pennsylvania, all of which shocked the U.S. Jewish community. But perhaps they shouldn't at this point. In the past Jewish year, we also said farewell to one of the pioneers of the fight against anti-Semitism, Abe Foxman, the formidable former head of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, whose work against anti-Semitism spanned decades. Now, it would be wrong to say that 5786 was a year filled only with anti-Semitic attacks, and the election or nomination of anti-Israel candidates and the platforming of virulent anti-Semites. But it would be correct to say that this has become, rightly, a year that crystallized the belief that anti-Semitism is reaching levels in the world we have not seen in decades. You know, it'd be nice to highlight great Jewish accomplishments over the past year. Nobel Prizes, Oscar, Emmy, Tony, and Grammy Awards, Jews elected to prominent positions around the world, Jewish success in sports and the arts. Of course, there have been many of those, but the prevailing story of this almost past year of 5786, unfortunately, has been the rise in systemic anti-Semitism, and perhaps worse still, the normalization of anti-Semitic beliefs, including conspiracy theories, in all kinds of segments of the population, growing ones, on the internet and social media all over the world. We can only hope that changes in the international situation, such as the likely defeat of Netanyahu in the October elections in Israel, may help change the narrative and diminish what has been a rising tide of anti-Jewish rhetoric, of publicity and violence over the last several years, before it becomes even more normalized and more dangerous. That is my too Jewish prayer for the coming 5787 year, that some sanity returns to the world, that the insane demonization of Jews in Israel begins to recede, But at this point, I'm afraid it's only a prayer, perhaps a hope, you know, hatikva. May it come to be a reality in this coming year. To play us in this morning on Two Jewish, here's a passage from the liturgy for the coming Jewish High Holy Days, Berosh Hashanah. On Rosh Hashanah it's written, and on Yom Kippur it is sealed. Who shall live and who shall die? Who will be content and who will struggle? Rosh Hashanah is now 3 weeks from Friday night and Saturday, September 11th and 12th. Yom Kippur, of course, 10 days afterwards.
Meroish Hashanah Yikasei Bo Uviyoim Tzoyim Kippur Yechasei Mo Meroish Hashanah Yikasei Bo Uviyoim Tzoyim Kippur Yechasei Mo
That was Berosh Hashanah by Cantor Struli Williger for the coming High Holy Days starting September 11th. Come to Congregation Beit Simcha, join us. You can do so, go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest will be Professor James Leffler, author of Exceptional Hatred, Anti-Semitism, and the Fight Over Free Speech in Modern America. It's a timely and valuable book. He's a true expert on the balance between free speech and hate speech. Meet him when we come back in a moment on To Jewish. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. James Leffler is a prominent historian. He is the Felix Posen Professor of Modern Jewish History at Johns Hopkins, author of books and articles, including Rooted Cosmopolitans, Jews and Human Rights in the 20th Century, previously taught at the University of Virginia, and has been published many different places. He's a Kogod Senior Research Fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America as well. His new book is called Exceptional Hatred, Anti-Semitism and the Fight Over Free Speech in Modern America. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
So I think this book couldn't be more timely. It's impossible for it to be more timely. The whole question of freedom of speech, which is kind of a Central American ideal codified in the Bill of Rights, and yet there are some limits. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I wrote this book because we were already entering what we're now in, which is a kind of a double crisis. We have a terrific problem of anti-Semitism in this country right now, and we have a crisis as well as a ferocious debate about free speech and its limits. And the goal of the book is really to give people a sense of how we have wrestled in the past with what are the proper limits on free speech. How do we do that in order to preserve civil rights without violating the First Amendment?
You begin with a description of your testimony in the Charlottesville March case. Tell us how that kind of codified things for you that way.
Yes. Yeah, so I, for many years, was a professor of Jewish history and Jewish studies at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. As people will recall, 2017 was a terrible year of violence and racism and anti-Semitism. And it raised questions about whether there was a way to prevent that kind of terror and bloodshed, and then how to punish people. So I was asked to be an expert witness in a hate crimes trial. And the defense said that this man on trial was simply exercising his free speech. He didn't break any laws, and he should not be prosecuted at all. And the prosecution, state prosecutor, said, no, this man broke civil rights laws, harassing people, causing them to fear for their lives. So I was brought in as an expert witness to discuss the symbols and the rhetoric involved in that violent march, and I was asked to do that. But it really drove home for me this difficult question about how we approach these problems in law and why we have the kind of First Amendment we have, its both strengths and its limitations.
Without giving away too much, you know, you mentioned how at the exact moment when they finally bring these guys to trial, there are students outside chanting from the river to the sea, and how the question of whether that's free speech, you know, or anti-Semitic speech, or both.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one of the great ironies that we have experienced is kind of both the appearance of anti-Semitism on the far right and far left, as well as these difficult questions about when a slogan is a political speech, it might be aggressive, offensive speech, and when it is something which can actually cause harm and include bias. So the other irony with this, as you've mentioned, the tail end of the prosecutions of the perpetrators of the 2017 Unite the Right rally in March coincided with a wave of campus protests and some responses, some of them necessary and some of them heavy-handed, to student protesters. So it brought up this strange juxtaposition about when a slogan is okay and when it's not okay, when it's legal, when it's illegal. And it brought up the core issue, which is that we need to be consistent in how we approach questions of speech. And if I've learned one thing, as many of us have learned on college campuses, is that when you're not consistent with the policies, everyone gets upset, everyone loses trust, and everyone tends to feel that their rights are not being respected.
We will talk much more with Professor James Loeffler. His book is called Exceptional Hatred, Anti-Semitism, and the Fight Over Free Speech in Modern America. Extremely timely, cogent, important. When we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in Catalina Foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this summer and fall. Established nearly 8 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary always. Call 520 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is starting now for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org to sign up. The High Holy Days are coming up fast. You can register as a guest. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. I, Rabbi Sam Kohan, lead them all. Wonderful music, inspiring sermons, great shofar, and wonderful, wonderful congregation. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everybody. You can come Friday night or Saturday morning. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Onig Shabbat. Saturday morning services are at 10 a.m., always followed by a delicious Kiddush. And there is Torah study at 9 a.m. every Saturday. Torah study is available on Zoom. Services are available as well on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes, and they are extensive, are taught live and on Zoom. You can access those through the website too, Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, Adult Education Academy classes, High Holy Day services, religious school, Torah Tikes program, Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, all taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail, or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store. It's a very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments really help. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, a story came out recently that impressive synagogue in the suburb, wealthy suburb of Paris, the Grand Synagogue of Levallois-Perret, you can correct my French, of course, had a number of Sefer Torah, 12 Torah scrolls stolen from it in a targeted theft. And it brought up the point that in France, there were some 1,300 anti-Semitic incidents last year. 53% of all anti-religious acts in France were against Jews, and Jews make up less than 1% of the population of France. Let's talk a little bit about where the anti-Semitism there comes from.
Sure. First comment is, I read the same story, and I was shocked that one synagogue
had 12 Torahs.
Not the main synagogue in the heart of Paris. Some relatively small synagogue in the suburb had a dozen Torah scrolls.
Isn't that incredible? That's a lot of Torah scrolls.
Plus, they assigned a commercial value as if the thieves could resell the Torah scrolls.
Which actually there is a black market in Torah scrolls. I know about it. But yeah, it's a little bit hard to put a. That's not the point.
Yeah, it just seemed odd to me. It's like, wasn't a theft of jewelry. You know, it was the theft of Sefer Torah, which are, you know, the center of Jewish life. So anyway, the question about anti-Semitism in France always annoys me somehow, because there's a belief that the French, whatever that means, that, you know, there's lots of types of French people and lots of different regions and lots of different languages, and the languages are not all mutually comprehensible, and France is an incredibly diverse place. It's like Europe in miniature. But people say the French are terribly anti-Semitic. And in my experience, that's simply not true. There are several sources of anti-Semitism. This incident was most likely caused by, there's a huge Muslim population in France that is not always well integrated,
right,
that feels like outsiders, and that are, again, not always, but often, economically disadvantaged, and they act out some of their frustrations about not being fully integrated into France or not sharing the economic pie of the country in an equal way. And they direct that anger against establishment figures. And in France, Jews are part of the establishment. You know, lots of ministers, there have been presidents of France who were Jewish, certainly prime ministers who were Jewish. And Jews are not outsiders, they're not marginalized in any way. So the obvious source of anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic violence is Muslims, mostly from North Africa, former French colonies like Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, whatever. But there's another older, long before Islam existed, source of anti-Semitism in France, and that is the Roman Catholic Church. And it is hard to overstate how deeply French consciousness is shaped by the church. France was always referred to as the most faithful daughter of the church. And when I was a much younger man, the U.S. government sent me for a year to an elite finishing school for people who want to be titans of industry in France, or titans of government, who want to run for the highest offices in the land, or who want to run the Supreme Court. This was a school that people plotted from before their kids' birth, how they could get their kids into this school and how they could prepare them for it. And really, I'm not sure it's 100% a meritocracy, but it's very competitive. And the people who study there are among the smartest and, one would hope, among the most rational people in France. Nonetheless, when I was there, one of my classmates got married, and he was not Catholic. He got married in a Protestant church, and I would say at least a third, if not two-thirds, of our classmates went to the reception after the wedding. They wouldn't go to the wedding because it was in a Protestant church, which they refer to as a temple, not a church. And they refer to it as if it's a pagan temple. The devil dwells there. And it just completely blew my mind.
Wow.
That this was in the 1980s. So this is not ancient history. But at the end of the 20th century, people were, highly educated people, were reluctant to the point of fear to go enter a Protestant church because of what they've been taught by their priests when they were children.
Incredible. You know, it's like they're refighting the Reformation, but 500 years later. Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Schwartz, an elderly Jew, was resting peacefully on the porch of his little hotel in Florida when he sees a cloud of dust up the road. He goes out to see who could be approaching. It's a farmer with a wagon. "Good afternoon," says Schwartz. "Afternoon," says the farmer. "Where are you headed?" asks Schwartz. "To town." "What do you have in the wagon?" "Manure." "Manure, eh? Huh. What do you do with it?" asks Schwartz. "Ah, spread it over the strawberries," says the farmer. "Well," says Schwartz, "you should come for lunch someday. Here, we use sour cream." I did tell you it was an old Jewish joke. It was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. What are the most important laws? Our weekly portion of Ki Tetzé in Deuteronomy obligates us to ask this question, for it's filled with an array of laws and ordinances affecting every aspect of life. They range from rules limiting unorthodox ritual practices to rules limiting conduct in wartime, from personal morality to behavior in society. Family laws are established concerning marriage, inheritance, divorce. Tort laws on damages are instituted, providing moral and financial responsibility for property owners. Laws of kindness decree human decency. Lots and lots of laws, 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 some obscure, some famous. In short, reading Ki Tetzé is interesting, but a little dry. Some of the legislation seems outdated, even irrelevant. But two sets of related laws established in Ki Tetzé alone would guarantee its place in the highest of moral realms. Both put into practical terms what the Torah has already stressed. When a person is in your power economically, you must not exploit their weaknesses. The first of these states that if you take as pledge an item of clothing from a poor person, you must return it before nightfall. In other words, you must not allow an impoverished man or woman to spend the night without proper clothing or shelter. This is a necessary reminder in our American society, which tolerates homelessness in a manner the much poorer world of the time of the Torah would never have done. The second law states unequivocally and memorably that you must pay a worker on the very day he or she completes their labor. In our society, delays of 2 weeks and even 3 weeks are common for payrolls, even for minimum wage employees who need the money the most. Again, the Torah, created more than 2,500 years ago, insists on a higher standard of morality for employers than even we do today. Labor has value. Honest work deserves immediate pay. It's a simple lesson, and one our society still hasn't learned. In an era in which employers are famous for demanding wage concessions, which are really pay cuts for the same or more work, while cutting benefits and jobs and, God knows, pensions, perhaps it's time to allow Ki Tetzé to teach us these lessons. We return in a moment on Two Jewish, our guest, Professor James Loeffler, author of Exceptional Hatred, Anti-Semitism and the Fight Over Free Speech in Modern America, explains that this is not the first era in which Jews have struggled with anti-Semitic speech and action, and how it has been balanced against the American principle of freedom of speech. Find out how we've dealt with it as a society in the past years, this century and earlier, and much more about how we might deal with it now. All when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
The Tel Aviv Plaza that became the center of Israel's campaign to bring home the 251 captives that Hamas kidnapped on October 7, 2023, will now formally be called Hostages Square. It's a permanent reminder of the more than two-year struggle that ended with the return of the body of the final hostage last January. Mayor Ron Huldai on Tel Aviv unveiled new signage at the plaza outside the Tel Aviv Museum of Art last week, formally adopting the name Israelis used for the site for close to 3 years. Hostage families and their supporters gathered at the square for mass rallies, weekly Shabbat gatherings, vigils, and public events demanding the release of those held hostage in Gaza. The plaza was filled with crowds celebrating when hostages returned home. Huldai said at the unveiling, "History cannot be erased. We must not allow it to be forgotten." The decision to name this place Hostages Square is intended to ensure that this chapter in the history of the State of Israel from October 7, 2023, until the return of the final hostage, Ron Gvili, January 26, 2026, will be remembered for generations. The formal designation, Hostages Square, settles a debate over whether the site's role in one of the more significant events in Israeli history would be remembered or erased. After a deal announced in October 2025 to free the remaining living hostages, Dani Miran, whose son Omri spent 738 days in Hamas Palestinian terrorist captivity, personally urged Huldai to rename the plaza Returnees Square. Other proposals included Heroes Square and names emphasizing unity, while relatives of hostages whose bodies were still being held in Gaza argued that the existing name must remain until everyone was returned. The last hostage, police officer Ron Gvili, was returned to Israel on January 26th after his remains were recovered in Gaza. The following day, the clock in Hostages Square that had counted the time since October 7th was stopped after 844 days. The site still carries political value. In July, protesters met at the square to call for an official inquiry into the lapses that facilitated the October 7th attacks, something Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu has fiercely resisted. The failures of that day have become an issue ahead of the October 27th elections. If you visited Hostages Square during the Gaza War, as I did, you could not help but be profoundly moved by the many displays created by the families of the hostages, created by Israeli artists and by ordinary Israelis. They were a powerful and painful reminder of the disaster of October 7, 2023, the deaths and torture of so many innocent Israelis, and the long, horrible captivity of so many others stolen from their lives. They will now all be memorialized, one hopes, permanently. In other news, Jewish businessman Bob Iger and Joshua Kushner are purchasing the NBA's storied Los Angeles Lakers in a stunning, record-setting $12.5 billion deal. That sale comes barely a year after the team's controlling stake was sold for $10 billion to Mark Walter, the billionaire CEO of Guggenheim Partners, who also owns baseball's Los Angeles Dodgers, the WNBA's LA Sparks, English Premier League soccer club Chelsea, the Professional Women's Hockey League, and Cadillac's Formula One team. Mark Walter is not Jewish. He is reportedly seeking cash to pay down loans in response to a year-long Department of Justice investigation into internal loans, what are called related party transactions, in which there was no disclosure of potential conflicts of interest between his Guggenheim Partners insurance companies and some of his many other entities. The Lakers sale is the latest in a string of recent high-profile NBA team transactions by and between Jewish business people, including Matt Ishbia's purchase of the Phoenix Suns from Robert Sarver, Gabe Plotkin and Rick Schnall's purchase of the Charlotte Hornets from Michael Jordan, and Mark Cuban, who is Jewish, of course, sale of the Dallas Mavericks to Miriam Adelson. Bob Iger, who is 75 years old, has ended his second stint as CEO of Disney earlier this year. He and his wife, Willow Bay, probably she's not Jewish, are the owners of the professional women's soccer club, Angel City FC. And finally, famed Jewish demographer Jack Euclid died last week at the age of 88 in Jerusalem. Euclid has lived there since making Aliyah in 2012. He was one of the most prominent members of a group of Jewish social scientists who, from the 1980s through the 2000s, played a central role in setting the agenda for organized Jewish life. Philanthropists and nonprofit leaders alike sought Euclid's data and recommendations on hot-button issues like intermarriage, attachment to Israel, population trends, and declining engagement with Jewish institutions. In 1981, Euclid joined the Jewish nonprofit world as senior planning officer of the New York Federation of Jewish Philanthropies, that's UJA New York Federation. He led the megacharity's first scientific study of New York area's Jewish population and led major studies on senior services and Jewish poverty. 5 years later, he went out on his own, launching Euclid's Associates, Inc. For 28 years, he led consulting projects that allowed him to study the Jewish world for all kinds of Jewish nonprofits. He had a stellar reputation personally, compassionate, Jewishly knowledgeable, modern Orthodox, committed himself. He always focused on how to create a successful vision for the communities and organizations he served. He was data-driven, but he cared about human beings, and he helped change the American landscape of Judaism. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest, James Leffler, professor, Felix Posen, professor of modern Jewish history at Johns Hopkins, author of Rooted Cosmopolitans, Jews and Human Rights in the 20th Century, professor at University of Virginia, a very prominent historian, the Kogod Senior Research Fellow at Shalom Hartman Institute. His writing has appeared in many prominent publications. His new book is called Exceptional Hatred, Antisemitism and the Fight Over Free Speech in Modern America. In exploring the question of free speech and anti-Semitism, you deal with three separate eras. The first, of course, the 1940s, and then the 1970s, and then you jump it kind of up to more or less contemporary times. Tell us why those specific choices.
Yes. So there have been a lot of moments in American history when we have seen episodes of anti-Semitism, right? But I chose those moments because they're moments that also coincided with these huge debates about civil liberties, about the character of American democracy, and about how serious anti-Semitism was to the kind of core security of American Jews. People often forget that the story of the Holocaust in America is one in which, despite Americans' horror as they find out what had happened in Nazi Europe, anti-Semitism doesn't immediately decrease. In the right after the war period, immediately after, there's an uptick, and it causes a real problem because American Jews really feel under assault. They feel that there are extremists targeting them, and it triggers these debates right at the moment when the civil rights movement is heating up about how much you can use the courts, how much you can use civil rights law to stop bigotry before it gets violent, or whether that is something that's going to backfire. So that was a very important moment with a lot of resonances for today's situation, and I wanted to kind of recover it. It also gave us some of the basic architecture of the laws that we use to try and deal with extremism and also preserve free speech. The 70s will be something that some listeners will remember, which was the Skokie affair.
Right.
And that,
Nazi march in Skokie where there were so many Holocaust survivors living.
Exactly. And it was a very divisive moment. The ACLU split in half. It almost went under because the ACLU chose to defend the neo-Nazis on grounds of principle. And American Jews really had to struggle with whether their commitment to the First Amendment meant that they should discount the dangers and the fears that the Holocaust survivors experienced, or whether they should press for more limits and restrictions on the speech of the radical neo-Nazi protesters. And one of the things I thought was interesting about that moment is that it tells us not only that this is a hard question of balancing these concerns, but also when you close one door, another door opens. So the outcome of that was, as people may remember, that the Nazis were allowed to march, but they didn't at the last minute. They diverted and went back to Chicago, but their rights were upheld. Out of that grew a lot of what we have thought of up to the present as the main ways in which you stop hate speech without messing with the First Amendment. And one of those is Holocaust education. It really exploded into American life. And people said, okay, well, let the neo-Nazis speak, let them march, but let's inoculate Americans against their hate by using the Holocaust to show what it was all about. And the second thing was the rise of hate crimes and the idea that you can actually punish certain crimes, not simply because they hurt somebody, but also because they were targeting someone's identity, harassing them, intimidating them. And that was seen as a way around this problem of the First Amendment. So I wanted people to wrestle with that because those are two things that we are continuing to debate today as we try and find solutions to the scourge of anti-Semitism.
You know, many of us are familiar with the famous line ascribed to Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. Am I right to my freedom of speech to shout fire doesn't extend into a crowded theater? That's not exactly right, but that's the gist of it. You do bring up the point that speech can harm. What are the limits of free speech?
Right. And I think that is the great question that was identified 100 plus years ago. There are always limits. And the question is how we define the limits so that they are consistent and realistic and don't lead to a slippery slope. We have come up with a system of time, place, and manner. You can say what you want to say, but there are ways in which you cannot use it anywhere because that could cause harm, that could cause public disorder, that could cause violence, or that could deny somebody else access to an institution access to their educational rights or just their civil rights more broadly. Those are things in the law. And one of the things I think we need to remember is it's always going to be a balancing act. One of the problems we've faced in recent years has been that sometimes the laws are applied inconsistently. And so you have situations where the federal government in particular comes down extremely heavy-handedly and draws with two broad strokes and how it treats things as threats. But also it generates a dynamic where we have to be very honest about what is a danger and what is an offense. And that's one of the things that I don't think anybody, Jews and non-Jews, people all over the political spectrum, have to be more honest about. When is something just extremely offensive, even despicable, and when is it actually causing danger? So our laws can do a lot of the work, and they might, as I argue in the book, they might have been changed to even give us more tools. But even as they are, they can do a lot of work to protect us as long as we really recognize what they can do and what the law lets us do, and we apply it even-handedly.
Anti-Semitism might be the oldest race hatred in existence consistently applied, and it has surged back both on the right and on the left. The Charlottesville example, of course, of the Unite the Right, but we're seeing it on the left. I used to be able to say, before a few years ago, yeah, there's anti-Semitism in America, but no synagogue has ever experienced a fatal attack unlike the ones that have happened in France and Turkey and all around the world. It's not true anymore. It's happened, and violence against Jews has been on the rise. What are the limits to what people can say today in their advocating anti-Semitic positions, which are now extremely popular in various podcasts?
Well, you mentioned podcasts, and that's one of the big differences between this earlier period in history and today, right? Without a doubt, the podcasts have been amazing. We're on one now, you know.
Yes, indeed.
in what I call the democratization of ideas, they've really let us talk to one another across distance in new ways. But the technology has also been something that's caused great harm and allowed hate groups to organize. And this was true in Charlottesville. And it's allowed hate to spread through the ecosystem of American life. So that is a challenge for us. The limits will depend on what the government does and what we empower it to do. And I think there have to be serious considerations about this. Right now, we've left private corporations to themselves to basically regulate what happens on their networks without any consequences for them. And I think there's a problem with that because it really means they have less incentive to really take seriously what's happening with their own networks and what's happening out there. The limits, though, however, are not a panacea. And if one thing I would say I want people out there to think about, it's not to react emotionally in the moment to what is immediately threatening, but to say, what do we believe is fair? What is the fair balance? Because you always have to have a limit, but also a freedom. And I think the key decisor should be when things begin to seriously demonize people and impair their rights to do the rest of their rights, right? That is the key thing. It shouldn't simply be something we find so offensive or so extreme. It should be when it actually tangibly touches somebody else, damaging their rights to privacy, their access to education, their rights to religious assembly, religious freedom, freedom of assembly. Those are the things. And if we have that standard in mind, it can help us navigate through something that's so difficult. It does occur across the political spectrum, and it is not going away.
It seems, in fact, not only not to be going away, but to be intensifying. When we started Too Jewish, which is now almost a quarter century ago, I remember having Len Dinnerstein on, who had written the book, Anti-Semitism in America. He founded the Judaic Studies Program at the University of Arizona. And people asked him about the rise of anti-Semitism. He said, anti-Semitism is declining. You know, it's nothing compared to what it was, which was true at the time. Mm-hmm. Boy, is that changed.
Yes. Well, I think it's important to recognize that there is a cyclical element to it. So for those of us who want to remain optimistic, right, that this is not destined to culminate in some new catastrophic period in Jewish history, leaving aside the tumult and anguish in the Middle East. But in the American context, we have been here in places that are eerily similar to this one before, and we've gotten through them. So I think that past scholars have identified certain moments and said, okay, it's no longer a problem, or we've never had this problem. Now we've had, as you said, unprecedented kinds of violence and attacks on synagogues. But that doesn't mean that we haven't been in a place before where American Jews have felt themselves singled out and felt themselves uniquely vulnerable. The trick is going to be thinking big about how to preserve American democracy. And I think the activists I talk about in my research understood that what they were doing would help Jews and help all Americans if they could set the balance of civil rights and freedoms, and if they could figure out ways to really target hate in a way in which it built trust among Americans, that this wasn't a political vendetta, or that this wasn't just a government power grab, but this was a democratic impulse in order to secure all of our rights.
In exploring this question over these three periods, and of course you could have gone much, back much further. I mean, I think of the only National Anti-Semitic Act grants expulsion of the Jews in the Civil War period, right? This is something that's crept in at various times. In a period of rising anti-Semitism in which there's also this kind of assault on the freedom of speech, how did Jews find a kind of middle ground on this? Where is the sweet spot on this?
That's a great question. I think the sweet spot has to come through, number one, identifying where are the places in which this is directly touching us. We're all going to argue. Jews are famous for, two Jews, three opinions. We're going to argue over Israel. That is inevitable. We're going to argue over right versus left. That's inevitable. I think we need to be really precise about when is this actually targeting or harming us? And the general sense that I don't like something, or the general sense that this is threatening to me, we're going to have to say, is that rise to the level of threat? But second, the most important thing is probably to ask, if we want this kind of protection, if we want the government to do X or Y, do we think that's the right thing if it's another group that is imperiled and targeted? One of the great strengths of American democracy has been the Jewish role in building civil rights and working with allies. A lot of that's been lost. A lot of that has been strained by politics, by Israel, by other factors. So I do think the goal should be not only to say, okay, certain things are extreme or we don't like them. It should be, as we imagine our future, what kind of civil rights do we want so that the Muslim American kid who goes to college feels just as safe and secure as the Jewish kid, and that they have a common interest in this? That's a kind of thing it's easy to pay lip service to, but that's going to take more work from the Jewish community and from other potential allies to really say, we agree on this. We've seen the mistakes, but I think we have been slower to imagine what's a better model of pluralism and civil rights going forward.
I want to thank Professor James Loeffler for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Exceptional Hatred, Anti-Semitism and the Fight Over Free Speech in Modern America. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the book?
Thank you. You can find me on social media or jamesloeffler.com. The book's available widely at bookstores and book sites, and I appreciate your interest in it.
Thank you so much. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be cantor Carl Sayers, exploring how composer Leonard Bernstein sampled Jewish music from Slichot in creating West Side Story. And join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, every Friday night. Services in Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2. 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for service and class schedule, and to sign up for our Torah Tykes membership and for religious school, which starts this week. And join us at Beit Simcha for the High Holy Days, led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. You can register as a guest at our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Joining our beautiful musical services, September 11th and 12th is Rosh Hashanah, the 20th and 21st are Yom Kippur. Our play out this morning on Too Jewish comes from the liturgy for the Slichot prayers, a very upbeat version of Rachem Na, sung by cantor David Dudu Fisher. My friends, have a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace. Na, 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 na
Israel Amecha, Al Israel Amecha. Rachem na 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 na, Hashem Elokeinu, Al Israel Amecha, Al Israel Amecha. Ve'al 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 Yerushalayim, ve'al 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 Yerushalayim, Al Yisrael Amecha, Rachem Na.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.